All right, so on the last lecture on Wednesday, I introduced mean field theory to you and how we were able to get qualitative results, and then when we had a high enough dimension, some quantitatively correct results there too. And we really didn't have to do that much work to arrive at the critical exponents. Today I'm going to talk about what's basically a different type of mean field theory called Landau theory. And we'll do roughly the same amount of work as what we did on Wednesday, but the cool thing is we'll get actually a much richer picture from that effort. So Landau theory is really a clever way to get a lot of information without much work. So let's say different approach to mean field theory. And we are going to ignore the details of the interactions. Produce a symmetry-based model that has makes sure that it has some qualitative features in common with what we would expect. And it also gives us an idea of why RG will work later on. But when we were thinking about mean field theory, what we were doing there is we gave a Hamiltonian, so some expression of the energy for the mean field theory. And then we worked from there to get various quantities. With Landau theory, instead of thinking about the Hamiltonian or the energy expression, we're going to think about the free energy instead. And this is going to be reminiscent of something I did last week when I was sort of introducing the free energy. But basically, we know that the free energy is something that we want to minimize if we're looking at a system in finite temperature. And there was a way to see that, and we're going to walk through some similar steps today, but we're going to define a specific type of free energy, which is the Landau free energy. So we have our partition function, and let's just think about it in terms of these spin vectors that we had. So we have beta times the energy, which is dependent on some sigma values and some magnetic field. And so remember, this was our lattice model. So the sigma was equal to sigma 1, sigma 2, all the way up to sigma n. So I am using this sigma, general sigma, to represent a vector of all the smaller sigmas. And then I could think about splitting up this partition function into organizing it in terms of the magnetization values that you could get. So I'm going to use little m to represent the magnetization of the system in this context. And so for each m, there is some group of sigmas that would give you the same magnetization. So, you know, there are various ways that you could, imagine you had one spin up and all the other spins down. That would be a particular magnetization. And then you could have any one spin up in the system. So there would be various ways to arrange the sigmas in order to get a particular magnetization. And then what we do next is we have a sum of all these various things, and we're going to approximate it as a sum over the magnetizations, and then replace this as an e to the minus beta n times what we're calling the free energy. So writing this as a single exponential. And so, you know, you could imagine you have a number of these terms and they have different energies, but then you could write them as a single quantity exponentiated. And then we would say, as n goes to infinity, this will become exactly equal to the term with the smallest f. Because as n goes to infinity, we'll just get one term in this sum will end up dominating. And so that's the idea of first coming up with some model for the Landau free energy that's dependent on M and H, and then minimizing this Landau free energy to figure out what's going on with our system. And so Landau theory is all about taking some assumptions and using these assumptions to generate some expression for a free energy, and then seeing what we learn. Another note, this is free energy per particle, as you can see, because I wrote it out with the N on the outside of this expression. So when we think about this free energy, we aren't really going to be thinking about the individual particles and how they interact with each other and what how you would write a microscopic model. Instead, we're going to be thinking in general about the symmetries that would be involved to develop a free energy expression. Okay, so let's think about the ferromagnet in general and its behavior, and therefore what types of assumptions we would want to put into the free energy. So for the Ising model, we assume that F is some function of the magnetization and the magnetic field, the external one. And we expect the following types of things. So the one thing, if we have F for a particular magnetization and zero magnetic field. If you remember that that what we saw on Wednesday, where we had H equals zero, and then we saw these solutions. And I didn't draw it well here, but it was symmetric. So you know, when H is equal to zero, if we're looking at T being below the critical temperature, we're going to have some non-zero magnetization. And it's going to be just as likely to be plus m as minus m. So the first assumption for this is that we're going to have this symmetry, that the free energy function at m for h equals 0 should be equal to the free energy function with minus m, that same minus m at h equals 0. You know, and if you're thinking microscopically, you can think, you see, E equals sum over ij, sigma I, sigma j. And you can take sigma I to minus sigma I for all I. And that's a symmetry. And so that would take the plus magnetization to the minus. Go ahead.
This graph is a function of m.
Oh, this one?
Yes.
So this was a recollection from Wednesday when we had that implicit equation for the magnetization.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like something, like some constant times the magnetization. We were looking at the solutions there for when T was below the critical temperature.
Yeah.
Okay, and then the other thing we're going to say is that when H and T minus TC are small, we're going to say that that this free energy expression is small. Well, and this is not exactly necessary. This is about being able to express this in terms of a series, and you could have a constant there. So maybe I'll just stick with M for here. But. But when you have some, not entirely sure about this one. So F, we're going to expect small deviations from, so let's say F minus F zero, where that's just some constant. Okay, and then the other thing is that M varies smoothly. With T. And that's something to think about in terms of what are we saying here? Because you know in terms of our data that if we looked at M versus H, and this is at T less than TC, we know we have a first order phase transition when H is equal to zero. So as we go and lower our H field, at first we have some positive magnetization, and then we jump down to a negative magnetization. On the other hand, if we're going to plot magnetization versus temperature itself and put TC here, and this is at, this is at H equals zero. We'll have equally likely to be a plus or a minus magnetic field. But then as we increase temperature, we will decrease down to zero at TC and then remain at zero when T is greater than TC. And this is what the plot looks like when H is equal to zero. So there's no favoring of a plus m or a minus m. And so that's what this is. We have a continuous expression of m varying with t. And so that's an assumption that will go into this theory.
Okay.
Okay, so now let's write this as some kind of expansion. So we can then write F as a Taylor expansion using these assumptions. And I'm going to stick with H equals zero for now at the beginning as we build this. So it could have some constant value, as I mentioned, but then we will be expanding in terms of M. Oh yeah, and so then that is, M is small up here. That's right. And so I'm going to expand it in something that involves the temperature. So I'm just going to call it a function of temperature for now. Plus another function of temperature this should be an m squared power and then an m to the fourth power. And we are already using our first assumption here because we want the function when m is plus to equal the same thing as the function when m is minus. So if you put in minus m here, you get the same thing. But this is why we are only expanding out for even powers when we're writing out the free energy. And then now we want to think about the form of basically these functions of R of t and U of t. One thing that I'm going to do that your notes don't do, but it makes things simpler, is I'm going to go ahead and set this constant equal to zero, because this is not going to have any effect on our critical exponents here when I think about the free energy. So I'm going to go ahead and set F0 equal to zero and then expand out. And then I'm going to say, well, as R of t, we can think of it as further expansion. It's going to be some function of the temperature. And we are going to expand around the critical point. So expand around t minus tc, or, you know, the absolute value when this is close to zero. So. And remember, we're going to call this little t here. And maybe we think about below criticality. So I'm just going to say. Okay, so then RK, we can expand in terms of this small parameter t to the k when we're close to criticality. And then for u of t, I'm going to expand using these little uk's. And so one thing in your notes, you actually just have R of t equals these things and U of t equals these things. So you will include the 4 factorial and the 2 factorial and various things. Again, these are constants. They don't change the critical behavior. So when I think about it right now, I decided to write it in this way so that I don't have these extra factors. One of the nice things, I think, with including the factors, it allows you to compare later on to 5-4 theory. I think that was the idea. But for now, I'm just going to write in terms of these. Okay, and so then let's think about physically what these things should be. So if when we say, so the whole point is we're going to be minimizing F. the free energy. And if we think about, if we were plotting something in terms of M versus the free energy, let's just think about the sign of the leading order term. What does the sign of the leading order term tell you about, let's say, you know, this large M behavior on either side? You know, what's the general shape of this if you just think about something F equals M to the 4? So if U is positive, then what does it look like if you think of M to the 4? Yeah, so we would get a parabola that looks like this. If U is negative, we would get a parabola that's this shape. And so if we are minimizing something, and, you know, if we think physically, we want this magnetization to be zero or growing larger, you know, depending on whether we're above or below the critical point, that tells us that for this coefficient and from M to the 4, we want a positive number so that when we minimize it, we have something that's close to zero here. So we're going to say that UT over 4 factorial, we're just going to have it be equal to U naught, and that is greater than zero. So that's the first assumption we'll make about these coefficients here when we're thinking about the Landau theory. And that's really the effect that U not greater than zero gives us for the large M. And now let's think about this R coefficient. And I'm just going to keep things general. So first of all, if RT is also greater than zero, how does that change this plot? And I don't know that much about curve sketching, so you don't have to give me like really much of anything. But if R is the same sign as U naught, then how's the plot going to look? Anyone know?
Yeah. I'm thinking it in the back of my head.
I mean, there'll be no roots, right?
Yeah. It actually still looks pretty similar to what we had before. On the other hand, yeah, and you're thinking about roots already. Like, what if we took the derivative and then we tried to solve for various things? On the other hand, if you have R of T less than zero, how does this plot change at that point?
It will have two minima.
Yeah, exactly. So now we really do get something different in the appearance. We'll get two minima. And so we see from this, basically, because we could imagine if we minimize it here, we could have something where M equals zero. If we minimize this one, now all of a sudden we have two minima, and they'd be something like some plus M minus M. So this term here is really going to be our mechanism to give us a phase transition at T minus TC. So when we think about R of T over 2, what we're going to say is we're going to put R naught equal to 0, and we're just going to say it's equal to R1 times T. Or I guess it doesn't need to be. So let's define T in a way that gives us what we would like. So that's why we want to define T as T minus TC. Because then if we are above the critical point, then this T would be positive, this little t. And so then we'll get this scenario here. On the other hand, if we are below the critical point, then this big T minus TC will be a negative number. And so then this term will be negative, and we'll get this scenario. So that's why we're going to say that RT is equal to R1T. And I'm using R1 because I'm just the second term in my expansion when I'm expanding something out close to the critical point. And so this is really the idea. We have some free energy expression, and then we think about the experimental results where we have some TC and above it we had zero magnetization and below it we had some finite magnetization that was symmetric, and we've just built a function that shares these qualitative features to what we would expect to see in experiment. Okay, so that means that we're going to write that this free energy, and just as a reminder of what the second argument is, this is still H equals zero here. So there's no external magnetic field yet. We're going to say, and I'll just use equals since this is how we're defining it, R1T M squared plus U naught M to the four. And we don't really include any higher terms because this already gives us the features that we were after when we were just trying to create something that some function that when you minimize it gives us the results we would like to have. And just to keep in mind, say, since we have the function explicitly, when T is less than TC, if you were to put this into Mathematica, and there is actually, again, an applet and a link to it in your notes where you can slide this stuff around and see how the function changes. But the free energy is going to be like this. And then as we get close to TC, these minima will get closer and closer together. Until they merge, and you get something that looks very flat down there, because it'll turn out that we'll have DF dm, both the first derivative and the second derivative will be equal to zero at the critical point. And then, of course, when T is greater than TC and we look at this expression, we will get a single minimum at m equals zero. Any questions so far about this? I mean, because it's really taking a few simple assumptions from the qualitative results, but it's it was a very clever idea to come up with in the first place, and it is rather deep thinking through. Okay, well, let's go ahead and use the math to figure out where these minima are, because that was the whole point. We want to minimize the free energy, and that will tell us about the magnetization. So we have df dm, and then the light's in my eyes, but we have two times R1 TM for the first term, Then if we take the derivative of the second term, we get 4u0 m cubed, and we want to set that equal to 0 to get the extrema. And then you know that you can factor out an m since that appears in both of these. So you know one of the solutions is m, not really a surprise, but then because m, of course, for all three of these scenarios is either a minimum or a maximum. So we have m equals 0, but then for these other things, we say that we have 4u naught m squared equals minus 2r1t. Or m equals minus r1t. And we have 2 divided by 4, so we should get a 2 in the denominator, u naught to the 1/2. And so this quantity could be, in here, it could be positive or negative, right? And so if it's, if the quantity ends up negative, we end up with complex numbers, and that corresponds to our scenarios here where we don't see those roots. But if this quantity is positive, then we get 2 more real roots, and that corresponds here. And well, what do we need in order to get real roots? What does this little t need to be?
You know, the critical point.
Yeah, less than 1. Mm-hmm. So we need, so when t is less than 0, or in other words, t minus tc is less than 0, so that's telling us we're below the critical temperature, 2 more real roots. And we know that those are going to correspond to the plus or minus roots that we see when t less than tc. But so that's what we built that into it. That's qualitatively what we said would happen, and now we're just seeing it quantitatively. But the important thing is, from this very simple thing, we see that m goes as t to the 1/2. And so without doing much, we see that the beta critical exponent is equal to 1/2. And so we very easily can get this first critical exponent from there. Let's see, Sean. Yeah, so I think I will do the specific heat next, because I don't need an ordering field for that one yet. Okay. So what about the alpha critical exponent? Which, as I mentioned, was if you take C, which is the derivative of the average energy with respect to temperature, it's going to go as T to the alpha. So let's get this one. Wanted to dwell on this one a little bit because we need to get an expression for the specific heat from the free energy, and you'll be using this in some of the other things too. So if we think back to the definition of the partition function, that's equal to, let's just say, the sum over the energies that we could have in the system times e to the minus beta e. That's the simplest way to write it for the canonical ensemble, since we've been working in the canonical ensemble with a constant number of particles this whole time. So if we look at the derivative of the log of this partition function with respect to beta, that is just going to give us, first of all, we do 1 over z, and then we need to actually take the derivative of this with respect to beta. Derivative of each term with respect to beta will give us the same exponent again, but then we bring down a minus e, because that's our constant relative to it. So we have a minus minus, so there's no minus anymore. And I think I will also put a 1 over beta here. Oh, wait, no, I don't have to do that because that was with respect to beta. Yeah, so we just have a minus minus, and then we have sum over e, e times e to the minus beta e. And so we see that this expression is just another way of saying the average energy of the system. So because of that, we can say that C is equal to the derivative with respect to T of minus derivative of log of Z with respect to beta. Any questions about this so far? Okay, but then beta, remembering that beta is equal to 1 over kt, we can say that d beta is equal to minus 1 over k, 1 over t squared dt, because ultimately we have a partial with respect to t and a partial with respect to beta. So it'd be nice to write them both in terms of a derivative with respect to the same thing. And then if we think about the free energy, which is equal to kt log of z, as we learned when we were discussing the canonical ensemble in the first place, we can write, and you can look at, you can get the details by working it out yourself. We can write that the specific heat is the second derivative of the free energy with respect to temperature. And you won't see this immediately, but if you make use of this expression and this expression and combine them into this, what you'll get is this expression for the specific heat. I think I'll keep the top one up since it's the introduction to everything. So then, for T greater than TC, well, we can see this from our qualitative plots. As we increase, at T equals TC, we know that there's still exactly one zero. Well, we'll get three roots and they'll all be m equals zero. And so the minimum magnetization is just m equals zero. And as we get higher in TC, there's still only one magnetization, which is this m equals zero. And so really the free energy there, you know, which we would write in this way, actually I didn't have it, there we go. This is just equal to zero, because M is equal to zero when T is greater than TC. And so then the specific heat is just also going to be equal to zero there for our theory. If I had some constant F zero, you know, at the beginning, then it would just be equal to F zero. But the point is it's a constant. But for T less than TC, we know that the magnetization is more complicated than that. And we figured it out over here. We figured out how the magnetization was dependent on the temperature. So we're going to use this expression here when we take the derivatives. So here, F0 is equal to minus R1 T minus TC. And then to leading order, because that's what we're interested in, M squared, I'm just going to put in that expression for M squared times R1 T minus TC over 2U0. And so then when I do that, I'm going to take the first derivative with respect to M, or sorry, with respect to T. And this is really some quantity squared. So I'm just going to bring a 2 down. It will cancel that 2. And then the derivative of what's inside is just T. So and I have T minus TC, right, so that's okay. And I'm a little confused here because I'm getting a negative number, but I should have a positive number. I don't know if maybe this expression should be a minus here. I'm not sure about that. I'll need to work it out again to make sure. But if, at least according to this, if I look at minus d squared f dt squared, then I'm going to take a second derivative of this and just get r1 squared over u0. And so this is also, notice, this is also some constant in terms of the temperature when I take the second derivative. So if I were to plot C versus T, and then look at TC. I really only know from this about when I'm close to T equals TC, but basically I have a line at zero, and then I have something positive. So the point is, for the specific heat, you're going to see a discontinuity in this function. But when we define T as t to the minus alpha. This tells us that alpha is equal to zero, because whether you are above or below the critical point, you just get a constant number. Okay, so now the other critical exponents we're going to get depend on once we add in an ordering H field. So now we're going to modify our free energy expression. So now I'm going to say that the free energy for M and for some H not equal to zero is equal to what I had before, which was our R1T M squared plus U naught M to the fourth. And then I'm going to add some ordering field. And actually I'll do a minus so that it orders it in a plus h equals up and minus h equals down, just to be consistent. I'm going to add an ordering field that is proportional to m. And let's think about how adding this kind of thing is going to change our expression. Because we were sort of getting to this on Wednesday, thinking about how the ordering field would change the roots and then change what behavior we'd have. So if I think about this function, and let's just think about the t less than tc case, and let's think about this h value being positive, what that's going to do, t less than tc, is instead of having these two roots that are equal, it's going to make them uneven. And so now, you know, we have two local minima, but there's only one absolute minimum, and that's this one, and that's going to force us to actually choose one magnetization versus the other. Which, by the way, if I think of t greater than tc here, that's going to have only one minimum again, but it's going to be a little bit lopsided, so not completely centered at m equals zero anymore. And in fact, if you were to look at, I think I erased the h equals zero version of this, but if we were to look at this m versus t when h is not equal to zero, then if we think about if we had some plus ordering field, then this would go down, but we'd always actually have some type of ordering. Because if you think about it, this is like the paramagnet. You know, even at a high temperature, we've got some ordering field. It will go to zero if we make the temperature go to infinity. Once it gets high enough, the magnetization would go away, but there's always something. So that's why you see the minimum as actually going to be on the right side for if we now have this ordering field included. It would look the same, and then this looks like a bump in the H negative case. And in this case, we have no phase transition. When H is greater than zero as a function of T. But But you do remember there was some kind of phase transition, right, when we were looking at M versus H. So where can we see the phase transition when we have this ordering field? Because let's remind ourselves of the full picture and the various aspects that we're modeling here. If we look in terms of temperature, you know we had some TC. And then if I'm looking at this as a function of H, we know we had ferromagnetic phases where all the spins were up or some all the spins were down below TC. And we know that this was a line of first order phase transitions. And then here, we have a second order phase transition. So the first part where I had no ordering field, we were really exploring along this line, the second order phase transition. To see the first order phase transitions, we want to look at a constant temperature below TC and then see what happens when we vary the H field, because that will bring us from one side to the other. So for T less than TC, for all these things, I already gave you the H positive version. And that was this lopsided one. And then at H equals zero, well, we already plotted that one before. That was when they are exactly equal. And then when H is greater than zero, sorry, when H is less than zero, this all is going to flip. And what am I plotting here? This is M versus F. So what you would see if you stayed at the exact same temperature, but then you varied the magnetic field, is you would be sitting over on this side until you hit H equals zero, and then you'd have equally likely, you know, this one. And then once you went to H less than zero, all of a sudden you'd basically jump from this magnetization over here to that magnetization. And so that's how you see the first order phase transition from the Landau theory. And so, you know, this is really another way of seeing in that H versus M plot, going down to this, and then going that way from the minima. And so we really are picking up all aspects of this phase diagram from this free energy expression that I've given here, F of M and H. Okay, so now that we have the H ordering field, we have what we need to get the other critical exponents. So repeating the expression here, we have F with M and H is equal to minus HM plus 2R1TM plus 4 not m cubed. Sorry, I'm skipping a line. This is just u not m to the 4, and this is r1 m squared. Okay, and so now minimizing with respect to m gives. So we need to take the derivative of this with respect to m again and set it equal to 0. So we're going to get minus h plus 2r1 tm plus 4u0 m cubed. And then at t equals tc, so at t equals tc, what do we say about little t? Yeah. So we say t equals 0. So we have that minus h plus 4 mu naught m cubed equals 0. Or, in other words, we have that m is equal to h over 4 mu naught. Did I do that right? So I put it h here, I divide by these items, and yeah, to the 1/3. And so notice now we've shown how how m goes close to the critical point as a function of h. And so now we very easily get this delta equals 1/3, sorry, delta equal to 3, since this is, and again, this Landau theory that we really just defined in order to give us good qualitative matching actually matches quantitatively with the mean field. I'm not going to show this one, but you can get the last of the critical exponent as, you know, chi is going to go as t to the minus gamma. And you can get that from chi equal to how does h change with respect to magnetization. Oh, and this is to the minus 1, because usually it's dm dh. So I'm just writing it in this way. Because it's going to be easier to compute from the Landau theory. And then you have this expression for the free energy, and you saw what it was when it was minimized. So you can say that H is equal to 2R1 TM plus 4U0 M cubed. And now you can get dHdM, and so then yeah, and let's just do one of the sides so you can see. I mean, it really is very, very simple to do compared to many of the other things. Right, so then dHdm is equal to 2R1t plus 12u0 m squared. And remember, this was equal to chi to the minus 1. So that tells us that chi is equal to 1 over 2R1t plus 12 u0 m squared. At criticality, we know that m squared is going to go to 0. So then from here, we can get that chi is going to go as t to the minus 1, or, you know, then that gamma is equal to 1. So now I really have gotten all of the mean field exponents, delta, gamma, beta, and alpha from Landau theory. So we're going to take a break in a moment, but before then, just so you know, we might talk more about this later on in the course, depending on how we're doing on time. But I briefly want to mention what Landau-Ginzburg theory is. So when you see it, you'll be familiar with the concept, at least. So it really is the sort of logical extension of Landau theory. I talked on Wednesday about the critical exponents, eta and nu, and how if you wanted to get those critical exponents, you needed to know about the correlations between the spins. But to really know the correlations between the spins, you needed to go beyond a mean field theory, because the mean field theory just assumes all the spins are an average spin value. They're the same. So you can't really figure out at this spin at site I, how is it related to this spin at site J? So you really need to promote it to a field theory in order to get correlations. And so Landau-Ginzburg theory is basically the promotion of Landau type assumptions to a field theory. And again, the attraction of that is it allows us to model correlations and fluctuations. So for Landau-Ginzburg theory, instead of taking this free energy expression that I have as our base, we are going to take a free energy functional as our base, where the magnetization is some field that now can take on different values throughout the lattice. So we are going to go back to a lattice and when we're thinking about Landau-Ginzburg theory. And so we would say this one, we would make similar assumptions before, you know, if we were trying to model the Ising model or the ferromagnet. So we'd have M, which is now a function of R. Let's see, squared plus, let's just say some B constant times M, which is a function of R to the fourth, and so on. But then, since this can vary, we would also say things about the gradients. You know, how do these fields change as a function of space? And we could think of some expansion there as well. And the point is, with this sort of thing, we can get eta and nu from it. And so then the partition function would be something like this full like path integral over all the possible paths you could have with the field values, e to the minus beta f. And as a note, if we're thinking about the case of the mean field theory we have, that's basically, we can reduce this back to the mean field theory by considering only constant mr. So if m was constant as a function of distance, this would be zero. We would only be considering constant values, and that actually reduces to Landau theory alone. So for most of the rest of the course, we're not going to be talking as much about the Landau-Ginzburg theory. We're going to be starting more systematically from a microscopic model and then building a field theory from there. But this is sort of the extension of the Landau thinking. You know, you think about some symmetries and you just write down a model that matches the qualitative features. Well, this is the promotion of that to a field theory. You now think about the symmetries and you write down something that has the symmetries you would like. Okay, yeah, let's go ahead and take a 5-minute break and then we'll continue. Yeah.
The first thing I have a question about is C is minus. Are you sure that, I think the C is minus T times this, right? On the second board, the middle board.
Okay, the middle board?
Yeah. Your definition for the heat capacity, isn't it T times second derivative?
No, there. If there is, then there should be some constant in there at least. So where are you getting the T? I guess. Did you write down it?
Yeah, I kind of like looked it up. I'm not correct, but when I checked it online as well, it seems like it should be. Maybe we can check later, that's okay.
Yeah, we can check later, that's fine.
I was just worried because in here, we're using that definition of F to like.
Yeah, and this ends up being important for the scaling hypothesis as well, because it is the second derivative with respect to T. It might be depending on the definitions of the free energy as well.
What about this is so well?
Yeah.
So good.
So here I've written it out. Okay, so we have this and we have these expressions. Mm-hmm. Now the first thing we can do is we can replace d beta by dt, and then we have a kt squared there. Okay, now if I think about the free energy here, and I take the derivative with respect to t, well, first I take the derivative of this piece, so I just k log z.
And you find it.
And then I take the derivative with respect to the log z.
So
that's kt partial log z partial t. So this is just an expression that I'm obtaining so that I can use it in a moment. Because I see that I have this, because I want to put in something for this. So if I multiply through by a t, by an extra t, then that gives me what I want here. So then I get this thing times t minus this thing, which is just the free energy, once I multiply it by t.
I mean, all what we'll be doing will be making this go Landau.
And so then, if I take the derivative of these things, I get df dt. Df dt, and then, oh, I have a t in there. Yeah, t times df. Okay, maybe that's where the mistake is. Minus df dt.
Yeah,
so it looks like there is a t at that point. Okay, so there should be a t then.
Okay.
Okay.
Nice. And also, I think there should be a minus or something because there's a.
Maybe when you do like.
This
month. Yeah, for some reason I get a minus here. But I mean, that's
okay. Like, somehow it's T.
Yeah.
But then I don't know how that changes this.
Well, if we think about the T then, and I think we think about the reduced temperature, that's really going to be 1 plus some very small little t. And so then the little t will go away. So we'll just have something that's constant to leading order. if we do
this.
Oh,
right, because that's T, it's not small mm-hmm. T. Okay,
yeah. Yeah, so because the point is we have to think close to the critical point and so what's going on there.
So
yeah. Now, I'll write up a little bit more notes just so everybody can see this, okay. Because that is a subtlety. Yeah. I do think, because that was something I was confused about the other day. Anyway, it's actually written correctly for the scaling hypothesis. Yeah. But I in terms of this one plus little t.
Sure.
But I will make sure that this is clear to everyone. Okay. Yeah.
And then the other thing is that somehow we promote this magnetization to be a function of just of space.
Yes.
Which means we like make it go from a global quantity to a local. How can we do that? So somehow you're thinking of magnetization as sort of local spin of
right. It's like it's telling you something about, if you think of a huge ensemble of these things, this particular spin, how much is it up or down? And that in the probability of how much it's up or down will also depend on all the other spins in the system. And so that's why this can actually model correlations.
But it's just that
also, what's your name?
Marco.
Marco, okay. Yeah, so I want to. So first of all, I want to thank Marco for noticing this. There should be a temperature here in this expression. Now, this does not change the qualitative results of the specific heat, because when you are looking close to criticality, that is like one plus little t. And so we'll get a constant still to leading order. For the specific heat there, and then we're looking at deviations away from it.
Emily?
Mm-hmm.
So like this theory is good in higher dimensions because on lattice I have many neighbors, so averaging is more justified.
Yeah, so as you get to higher dimensions, you have less potential for fluctuations, basically.
Because of many neighbors?
Yeah, like many neighbors encouraging the spin to just match whatever it's doing. So the thermal fluctuations are less as you have higher dimensions, and the coordination number at that point is sufficient to tell you about what the system's doing. Because remember, that coordination number Q was the number of nearest neighbors the particle had. And so then that really was enough alone to tell you what the TC is equal to.
If I want to cross it, I'm going to cross it.
So now we're going to discuss the scaling hypothesis. And this really follows nicely from Landau theory. Do you have a question?
Yes. What happens if I take something like 2D Ising and I take very many neighbors? Can I describe it using mean field theory?
Oh, I see. So if you had a lattice with a whole bunch of neighbors for that. Yeah, I...
You mean non-square lattice?
Yeah.
So I mean, some things like the triangular ends up being more complicated even though... So yeah, there's more than... Yeah, I think it's... And I can't remember which changes were relevant and which ones are not. So I'm not sure if I can answer that question. But this is something I mentioned on Wednesday because somebody asked me about critical exponents. And I said, it turns out that only two of these are independent. So looking from Landau theory, we're going to sort of motivate where that came from. Because this is something that experimentalists started seeing when they were measuring these critical exponents and only finding that they seem to be related to each other. And we can sort of get there from thinking about the Landau theory free energy expression. So from Landau theory, we got, and so I'm going to start out with a specific expression that came from what we were thinking about at the beginning of class, but then I'm going to generalize it. And this is not really a justified generalization, but it's something that we've seen to be consistent. And then you can use RG arguments to actually show relations later on. But just to recall, this was this first derivative that we set equal to zero, but then we could solve it for h, and so we had this expression from Landau theory. I'm going to mark it with a star because we'll return to this equation. And then we also got this beta critical exponent. And that, of course, is for when t is less than tc. Okay, so motivated by the fact that m scales in this way, let's rewrite this equation by dividing by t to the 3/2. And I'll show you why I'm saying t to the 3/2 in a moment. Because right now we have this t parameter temperature, we have magnetization m, and we have an external field, H. But we also know that M and T are related to each other. So instead of having these three parameters, when we're close to criticality, we have this constraint. And so we really only have, and you'll see it in a moment, we should be able to write it in terms of maybe two things that can change independently of each other instead of three, because M is also related to T in this way, close to criticality. So if I look at this and we just divide it through by H to the 3/2, we have H over T to the 3/2. Sorry, we're dividing through by T to the 3/2. We can write that as 2R1 m, and then I'm going to separate out t to the 1/2 from that, and then the remainder I have t over the absolute value of t. So notice that's going to be some order one quantity. That's just going to be the sign of your temperature, of whether you're above or below the critical point, plus 4u0, and then I have m over t to the 1/2 cubed. So I'm just rewriting it in this suggestive way. I have t to the 3/2 here. These are t to the 3/2. This is t to the 3/2. But I've just written it in this way. And so notice with the h, whenever there's an h, which there's only one, but it's scaled by t to the 3/2. And whenever there's an m, it's scaled as t to the 1/2. And this is just the sine of t. So this is order one. So it's not really something that is scaling in an interesting way. So this equation relates h over t to the 3/2 to m over t to the 1/2. So we could say that h over t to the 3/2 is some function of m over t to the 1/2. So then we could just write this mathematically. We could say it the other way, that m over t to the 1/2, if we solve for that quantity, is equal to some function of h over t to the 3/2. Okay, so now still thinking in the specific context of this Landau theory, returning to the free energy, F equals minus HM plus R1T M squared plus U0 M to the 4 we can write in terms of M over T to the 1/2. So here I'm really just going to write each of these directly in terms of m over t to the 1/2. So I'm going to divide by t to the 1/2, multiply by t to the 1/2, and so on. So we have minus h times t to the 1/2 times m over t to the 1/2 plus r1t times absolute value of t times m squared over the absolute value of t, because then I have 2t⁻¹ down here to scale with m, and I have this t up there. So I haven't changed anything. I'm just multiplying numerator denominator by appropriate things so that I can scale the magnetization the way that I'd like. And so notice I wrote here that I can write this m over t to the 1/2 as a function of h over t to the 3/2. So that's what I'm going to make use of, because I have these m's, but I would like to write everything in terms of only 2 parameters. So I'm going to write them in terms of h over t to the 3/2 as well as m over, so I'm going to write them all in terms of h over t to the 3/2. That's right. So instead of m over t to the 1/2, I have some function of h over t to the 3/2. And then this one is h over t to the 3/2. This is function is squared. And then we have t squared times some function, again, the same function, but then it's going to be raised to the 4th power. Okay, so I have the free energy, and it's in terms of these h quantities now. But then I also want this h to look like these other H's. So we truly have, you know, the same variable here. And so to do that, if I want this to be H over T to the 3/2, then what does the numerator have to be to keep it from changing? Because I want T to the 3/2 down here. So then what does this need to be? T squared, exactly. Because then if I have T squared over T to the 3/2, I'm back to just T to the 1/2. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull out a T squared motivated by that. And if when I pull out a T squared, what we're going to find is that everything is going to look nice. So I'm going to get minus H over T to the 3/2, because that's what was motivating us, times this function. And then if I have a t squared out here, then that means that I must actually have a t. Let's see. I want to get t, so I would have t over t. Now I'm just confusing myself. Oh, I need a t in the denominator, right? Because if I have t squared divided by t, absolute value t squared divided by absolute value t, that just gives me the absolute value of t again. So this is R1 t over the absolute value of t, which let's just remember that. That's just our order 1, or our exactly equal to 1 sine of t there. Function of h over t to the 3/2 squared plus, and now this one is easy, right? I pulled out this t squared, so now I don't have anything for that last term. So u naught times function of h over t to the 3/2 to the 4. And I should have a closed parentheses because I factored out that t squared, absolute value t squared, from everything. And so the point is that allows me to just say that the free energy is equal to T squared times, you know, I'm just using this general term to mean a function. It's a different function from before, but the point is it's just a function of H over T to the 3/2. So we have shown that F is dependent on only two parameters when we're close to criticality. At criticality, H and T. And you can have this idea of a scaling relation, which will be useful to think about next week when we ask about how things scale. You could think that if you took this free energy expression and you multiplied the T by a lambda, and you multiplied the H by a lambda to the 3/2, and we can think more carefully about how to get this later, but I just wanted to note it. Then I could take these values, put them directly into my expression, and T, if T went to lambda T, I would get lambda squared T squared. And then for this function, if I put in lambda 3/2 H in the numerator, and then lambda T in the denominator, I get lambda again to the 3/2 T to the 3/2, right? Because this lambda would then also be raised to the 3/2 power, just like T was. But that's exactly what we had before. So you can say that this is equal to, this lambda squared is a new thing, but this expression other than the lambda squared is exactly what we had before. So this is equal to the free energy of T and H without the scale. And so this is something that you'll see in your tutorial next week too, which is called a homogeneous function. If you scale these in a particular way, then it just becomes what you had before they were scaled, but multiplied by some constant scaling factor. Okay, almost done. I'll just give you now the generalization now that we have this expression. So what is the generalized scaling hypothesis exactly? Well, we have the free energy in the context of the Ising model as some function that has an argument of H over T to the 3/2, we're going to generalize it to the free energy is equal to T of 2 minus alpha, that's your alpha critical exponent, times some function of H over T to the delta, where this delta is a new critical exponent. This is called the gap exponent. And why do we have 2 minus alpha? Well, that's related to, we know that the specific heat should go as T to the minus alpha. And we know that the specific heat is related, is given by 1 plus little t d squared f dt squared, which I messed up their derivation a little bit, but I'll give it to you later on. And the point is then that if you take 2 derivatives of this f, that will get rid of this 2 out front, and it'll give you the minus alpha that you want to have. So that's why we have the alpha directly in this free energy for the scaling hypothesis. And what you will do in your tutorial is you'll just start with this generic looking function, and you will calculate the magnetization, or the equivalent of the magnetization, and various things. And what will happen is you will find relationships between alpha and delta and the various exponents. So just as a note, if we say m is equal to minus df dh, we can get minus t to the 2 minus alpha minus delta times the function of h over t to the delta. And then also knowing that m goes as t to the beta, we can get that beta is equal to 2 minus alpha minus delta. And so this is the first expression you will get that will relate various things. And then you can also get some of these other relations that have, some of them have names. Some of them were discovered earlier before then this scaling hypothesis was developed. One of them is called the Rushbrook relation, and it's alpha plus 2 beta plus gamma equals 2. And then you'll also be able to get this one, which I don't think has a name, which is delta is equal to this big delta, this gap exponent, over beta. And then this Griffith's relation, which is that alpha plus beta times the little delta plus 1 is equal to 2. And from this, we get that there are only 2 independent exponents. And you might ask, okay, well, what about eta and nu? Well, for those, you do need to add an additional assumption. It's called the hyperscaling assumption. That the lattice to the P, or the length of the lattice to the P, goes as the correlation length to the P. But you can basically use the idea of this Landau-Ginzburg functional. You can use some dimensional analysis to get relations that relate eta and nu to the other ones. So this one is called the Fisher, which is that gamma is equal to nu times 2 minus eta. And then this one's called the Josephson, which is that alpha is equal to 2 minus nu times d, where that's the number of dimensions. And if you want to read more about the dimensional analysis, you can look at Tong's statistical field theory, and that's section 3.2.1. And yeah, I mean, I've already run way over time, but I wanted to get to this stuff because some of your tutorial will be related on taking derivatives of the correct quantities in order to learn things about how the exponents are related to each other.